Up next on the 21st, we'll hear from two University of Illinois students who went home to Wuhan, China, about life under lockdown there and what we may be able to expect here. And more than 11,000 people in the state have received testing for the novel coronavirus, but some areas are reporting testing shortages. Who can get tested in Illinois and how? Plus, research analysis from the University of Illinois suggests that practicing yoga may lead to better brain health. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. And our show begins after the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Just ahead, we're going to talk with three reporters about testing in Illinois, who is being tested and is it increasing. Our state now has 1,500 individuals who have tested positive for COVID-19, and a dozen people have died. The epicenter in the U.S. is now New York City, but 2 months ago it was Wuhan, China. And we start with an Illinois connection to that area. The number of Chinese students studying at American colleges stands at more than 360,000, and many of them have chosen Illinois schools to continue their education. The University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign has one of the largest Chinese student populations in America, drawing nearly 5,800 students from the communist country. Hundreds also attend DePaul, Northwestern, and Southern Illinois universities. And for many, dealing with the coronavirus has meant isolation since the start of the new year. Flashback to January 23rd. This was being reported on NPR's Morning Edition by Noel King.
The outbreak started in the city of Wuhan in central China. Authorities there say they are in a state of war to keep it from spreading. They've stopped all public transportation within the city, and they've canceled flights and trains that are leaving the city. 11 million people live in Wuhan, so this might seem extreme, but more than 600 people are now infected and 17 have died.
That was January 23rd. On March 23rd, just 2 months later, there are more than 372,000 cases of the coronavirus disease worldwide and 16,000 deaths reported. Schools are closed, and our state is under a stay-at-home order, which sounds somewhat familiar to our next two guests, who are University of Illinois students from Wuhan, China. They went home for Christmas break last December and haven't been able to return to classes in Champaign, Urbana. 19-year-old Bo Chin is a second-year graphic design student. He is on the line from Wuhan. Hello, Bo.
Hi there.
And 19-year-old Hong Yu Wu is a second-year civil engineering student. He is also on the line from Wuhan. Hello, Hong Yu.
Hello.
And we have to mention Wuhan is 13 hours ahead of us in the central time zone of the United States, so they're staying up late to talk to us. Hong Yu, so when did you learn you were not coming back to the U.S.?
At the beginning, I didn't realize that the government will block the whole city for such a long time. So I emailed my faculty advisor and I asked her whether can I return school to resume this semester or not. But she said, no, you should gap this semester. There's no way you can get back to school on time. So,
Bo, what was it like to be in a lockdown city?
Yeah, it's really different from like the regular what was going on in the whole city. Like there's a lot of traffic jam going on before the virus outbreak, and now there's barely cars are going on the streets, and the people, there's only some pharmacy stores and some convenience stores are still open and except those, there's no shops are open.
And Hong Yu, let me ask you, when you found out that you weren't going to fly back for this semester, you know, how did that make you feel? What was going through your mind that you wouldn't be able to come back for school this semester?
I was very anxious because I've registered for 18 credit hours courses. I have to pay the rent of my apartment without living there. And I also have already paid the tuition, so I have to apply for the refund. And the complicated procedure I have to go through is the re-enter procedures, because gapping a semester for international students meaning that I have to apply for the visa again, because they're suspending my I-20, so I have to reactivate my visa. And yeah, there's a lot of emails going back and forth with the schools.
Both of you live in a city of 11 million people. Let me ask you, Bo, do you know anyone who has actually become ill because of the coronavirus?
Luckily, the people around me are actually, as I heard, there's no one get affected or have some symptoms.
And Hong Yu, how about you? Do you know anyone who has become ill?
No, I don't know anyone who's ill.
Do you get to leave your apartment at all? Have you been able to go out in the last 2 months?
Yeah, I can go out, but not go out of my apartment complex. I can like walk within the 2 blocks distance just for buying the food within my apartment complex, but I am not allowed to go out of the apartment complex. So yeah, the thing is I can't go out. I usually go out home like once or twice a week, but I don't usually go out because I think it's still dangerous outside.
And Bo, what about your classes for graphic design? Have you been able to complete any coursework from the University of Illinois?
Unluckily, no. So it's really complicated. As my major graphic design, there's barely any graphic courses are available for me online. So my only choice is to gap this semester and to take it in the fall semester. And also, I cannot take it in the summer courses because there's no design class are open.
So you're there in your apartment for 2 months. How are you passing the time?
Not too much. I'm like besides just practicing my skills on my academic field, like just playing around with the design tools and spending time with my family, and not much going on, and just killing time by playing games and reading something.
Hong Yu, I understand you've picked up some other hobbies. I mean, how are you passing the time?
I would like to watch TV series, and I've been playing guitar a lot because I sometimes get emotional or sad, so I like to play guitar to make me feel better. And I also like to take care of the plants in my home. I do the watering and spraying water and fertilizing. And I usually like to look outside, open the window and breathe some fresh air, do all the things that can make me feel more relaxed and make me feel better.
And I understand you now say habla español, right?
Yeah, I've also been learning Spanish by myself, because I have a minor in Spanish.
You like to play sports. I mean, how have you had to put that aside?
Because I like to play basketball and badminton, but like, you know, in home I cannot do those sports. I am a very active person, so not being able to do those sports made me feel pretty sad. But happily I figure out some way to make up that. So I sometimes do some push-ups, and I would like to stretch my bodies, like do some like small sports that in home that can make me move my body and get me in a better situation.
We're talking with Bo Chen and Hong Yu Wu, University of Illinois students on lockdown for nearly 2 months now in their native city of Wuhan. Bo, I want to ask you, what do you miss about being here at the University of Illinois and being here in America?
I miss the friend I made in the campus and all the teachers and including the advisors who are helping me how to overcome this situation and help me with my further academic field. And my friends, my teachers, and also the whole campus, what the campus brings to me.
And what about you, Hongyu? What do you miss?
I miss the time that I can walk on the main square without having to wear a mask. And I miss the time I can attend school, I can take classes, I can walk around the buildings to take different classes. And now, because in a quarantine life, I don't actually have any classes to take. So it's kind of like make my life less meaningful. So I miss the time that I can actually learn things in school.
You know, many of your American counterparts and even some Chinese students who didn't go home are now finding out what it's like to have more restrictive movement here in Illinois. Stores are now closed. A stay-at-home order is in effect. Hongyu, what advice would you give for someone now forced to spend lots of time inside their home?
I would suggest them to spend less time on social media, like seeing all those negative news. I always say it's better to relax yourself, do all the things that's necessary to make you feel better. And also, when you have to go out, be sure to do all the things necessary that can prevent you from being infected, like wearing a mask and always use hand sanitizers or washing hands.
Well, what does it appear that things are starting to get back to normal there in Wuhan, or what's it like right now?
It's actually getting better. Like the new confirmed cases is actually dropping. So I'm available to go outside today if I have the permission, and I think all the transportation is going normal right now, but I'm not too sure.
What will you remember about this experience, Bo?
I think this just remind me of how valuable life it is, and I think people, they all need to be prepared for what is going on, and to learn more about what is coronavirus, how to get protected and prevent from it.
Will you remember, Hongyu, years from now? You know, what will you tell people about this time?
I would say it's the most unexpected experience of my life. There's never been a situation that the whole city of 10 million of people are just being shut down suddenly. So I would say this is an unforgettable experience for me, and tell me how to deal with the sudden change in my life. So there's an old saying that the plan is never faster than the change. So I should always be ready for the new things, the change in my life, and I should always be ready. And also I learn how to protect myself from the virus. So if in the future there is another virus outbreak, I will be more prepared.
Do you hope to come back to school here at the University of Illinois and finish your degree?
Yeah, sure. I really want to start it, like get my life going. I want to take those courses and improve myself. And I also want to do some internship and research that can enrich my knowledge in my field.
And Bo, what about you? Do you hope to come back and finish here at U of I?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I would like to meet my friends and my teachers again, and also to resume my study on campus. That is for sure.
We've been talking with Bo Chin and Hongyu Wu. They are two 19-year-old University of Illinois students who've basically been in lockdown in Wuhan, China, as a result of the coronavirus crisis, and they shared some of their experiences and some advice for us here in the U.S. about how to pass the time. Thank you all for being on the line with us from China.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Christine Herman, health reporter for WILL's Illinois Newsroom. She's been speaking with emergency physicians in Illinois who are on the front lines caring for patients who are hospitalized with COVID-19. And she joins us on the line about what she's been hearing. Hello, Christine. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Reginald. It's good to be here.
So what is it like for emergency room doctors in Illinois right now?
I spoke with Dr. Ernest Wong. He's president of the Illinois College of Emergency Physicians and also a clinical professor and chief of emergency medicine at North Shore in Evanston. He says right now hospitals across Illinois are starting to see a spike, a real spike in cases of COVID-19, as we've been seeing in the numbers just going up day after day. He says it hasn't gotten to a crisis point yet, like we're seeing in other hospitals in other states right now, but they are bracing for that possibility.
The way I describe this to my friends and family, we're on a surfboard and we're watching these waves come, and we don't know which wave is going to be the one that we're going to get hit by, and we don't know how big it's going to be or how long it's going to last, but we have to be ready at any time.
You know, and I've heard from other ER doctors as well. One who I spoke with in Central Illinois says for now they're not having to ration protective equipment or go without masks and things like that we're hearing happening in hospitals in some other states, but they are trying to find creative ways to extend the lifetime of the masks that they're using, sanitizing them and reusing them. And they say that it's scary to think that they could run out at some point, you know, as we are seeing in hospitals and other places, because we know, as we know, there is a nationwide shortage of masks and other protective equipment.
Christine, we've got less than a minute in this segment. Imagine this is a scary time to be in the ER.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what Dr. Wong told me. Yes, it's scary because of all the unknowns, but at the same time, he says this is the very thing that emergency room doctors are trained for. Let's hear what he has to say about that.
You know, every day I see these patients come in, I see them at the bedside, and it's, you know, it's, you do the job. You swallow your fear, you swallow your anxiety, you gown up, and you go in and do the job. And that's what kind of sets emergency physicians. That's the soul of an emergency physician. It's different than other areas in medicine. And I think you can't do this job unless you're able to do that effectively.
And we were talking with reporters about the topic of COVID-19 testing. You're listening to The 21st, and we'll continue that in a moment. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We were just talking in our last segment about emergency physicians in Illinois and some of their concerns about COVID-19, especially being right in the front lines of this battle. Let's join again with WILL health reporter Christine Herman. And I just really want to just to wrap up our last segment, what do ER physicians say they need right now from public officials and folks in the everyday public?
Yeah. So what they're saying is they need people to take the warnings about social distancing seriously, because we know that's what it will take to help keep the healthcare system from getting overwhelmed. And, you know, Dr. Ernest Wong, president of the Illinois College of Emergency Physicians, says we also need to see a coordinated effort at the federal, state, and local level. So that's what he's saying is needed from public officials. We need to be able to track where is COVID-19 spreading. And to really to do that, we need more widespread testing, because otherwise, he says, it's like flying blind. You don't know who's sick, and you don't know who can possibly spread this to other people.
If you don't know who has it, you can't accurately quarantine, isolate those people, and then they're going to spread it. The key is, if there's an outbreak, you want to be able to just quickly quarantine them. And we know that that works. That has been effective if you can get it early. But if you just kind of let it fester, then, you know, the doubling rate is every person infects 2 to 2.5 other people, and the doubling rate is every 2 to 3 days, it rapidly spreads, and then you lose that window of opportunity to contain.
Christine, thank you for sharing that interview with us. Let's shift now to testing, and at least 11,000 people have been tested for the coronavirus in the state, but that number is much lower than the number of people health officials say have likely been exposed. And now, with Illinois under a stay-at-home order to keep the COVID-19 outbreak from spreading, some have wondered if more widely available testing could have prevented some of the extreme measures our state and the national government have had to take to keep people apart. And we are continuing to be joined by Christine Herman, health reporter with WILL's Illinois Newsroom. We also want to bring in Mary Hansen. She's a reporter for NPR Illinois in Springfield. Mary, welcome. And Also, for some national perspective on testing and the rollout by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, we're joined by Roshana Pruden. Hope I pronounced it right. She covers health policy for Kaiser Health News. Roshana, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Christine, back to you. If someone wants to get tested in Illinois for the coronavirus, is there a standard protocol across the state for who can get a test right now?
Yes. So for now, the bulk of the testing is being done by state public health labs that are located in Chicago, Springfield, and Carbondale. So across the state, and they have over the past few weeks kind of expanded the prerequisites for testing, the requirements, so that more people can qualify. So initially, you had to have had contact with an infected person or traveled to an area that has been hard hit by the coronavirus. But now the Illinois Department of Public Health says people who are hospitalized with illnesses that can't be explained in other ways, and also people who are living in living facilities like nursing homes, in places where there are confirmed cases or likely cases, they can also qualify for testing, but they're keeping it narrow because testing is limited. But at the same time, more hospitals across the state are now being able to develop testing on site, and they also contract with commercial labs. So in those cases, hospitals can set their own criteria, but from what I see, or at least from the hospitals I've checked in with across central Illinois, they're keeping the same criteria because even testing through commercial labs and through hospital labs is limited because there's a shortage of supplies.
South Korea has been seen as a sort of model for being able to stop the spread of this virus, and part of that is due to the availability of testing there. Roshana, you have reported on COVID-19 testing nationally for Kaiser Health News. Where exactly did the U.S. go wrong?
Well, I think there are several reasons why the U.S. has not been able to ramp up its testing capability, and they are all discrete reasons. So one of the biggest ones that I'm sure you guys have touched on readily is just a lack of testing supplies. The CDC developed its own COVID-19 test early on, got an emergency authorization for that from the FDA in early February. And as part of their response, in an attempt to increase testing around the country in state labs, they started shipping those test kits to state and other local labs around the nation. What a lot of officials quickly realized is that the testing was faulty. It was delivering inconclusive results. And so that really set people back a lot. There were shortages of other materials like chemicals that are needed to detect whether the virus is present. And then all of this sort of snowballed so that essentially the public health labs were really overwhelmed. I think one big point to make is that our public health labs were never designed to do really widespread testing in this sort of pandemic kind of scenario. The U.S. Inherently sort of our public health infrastructure very much relies on the private sector to be able to leverage to do widespread testing. And what happened was, this is also a major problem as to why things did not get off the ground quickly, is that we didn't leverage labs that are run, say, jointly with academic medical centers, with some of our commercial laboratories like LabCorp and Quest and all these names we know. So they were also hamstrung in being able to ramp up their testing initially, and it really put us very far behind in being able to detect the spread of the virus. So you have all of these reasons, and now I think we're just barely getting to the point where we're starting to catch up. But essentially, states between the faulty technology and the inability for private sector partners to collaborate with state officials, a lot of places were set back really by about a month. And in a case where an outbreak spreads so rapidly and people don't know if they even have the virus, a month is a very, very long time to fall behind.
Mary, you spoke with a woman named Abigail a few weeks ago about her experience trying to get testing in Springfield. When did Abigail first suspect that she might have COVID-19 symptoms?
So she told me about a week and a half ago. She's a nurse, and they were, taking their temperatures at work, and she realized that hers was a little elevated. So she, left work immediately, sort of realized over the weekend with some news coming out about, new cases in Springfield that she might have been exposed. So she said she's been staying in isolation, staying home, you know, following the, in quarantine, following the rules, you know, not going out, you know, limiting contact with people like that ever since then.
And does she know her results yet? Or, you know, what is the process for her to get tested? And does she know her results?
Sure. So she told me that she, you know, first called the County Department of Public Health, which, you know, as similar to a lot of counties around, has set up a hotline for people to call in if they think that they might have symptoms. So the nurses there asked, you know, a lot of questions about her symptoms and things like that, and referred her to a respiratory clinic that was set up by one of the health systems here in Springfield. She said she called them, waited for a nurse to call her back, and they sort of went through a whole, you know, more questions, more discussions about her symptoms. And then they had to call the Illinois Department of Public Health. That's, as we mentioned, the state health labs are one of the places that people are getting tests from, but you have to meet the criteria. So at that point, they told her that she should go in and give a sample, but you know, they told her to go to the drive-through clinic, one of the drive-through clinics that was set up here in Springfield. But that first her test would be screened for the flu or the common cold. And this is, again, because of testing shortages. They sort of want to rule out things, you know, reasons that you could have, you know, an elevated temperature or, you know, a cough or things like that. Rule out those things like the flu and the common cold first before getting screened for COVID-19.
We just heard Mary reference the drive-through clinic there in Sangamon County. Christine, if a person is listening to this show in Bloomington Normal or Champaign Urbana, do we know if they have any drive-through clinics or testing facilities there?
So I was looking at reporting from our partner station, WGLT. What I'm seeing is that the testing is still very, very much limited. I know they've done some reporting on ambulances transporting sick people if they you know, need to be coming to the ER to get to be hospitalized and to be tested. But, you know, there's 9 cases in McLean County confirmed so far, 4 cases in Champaign County. And in Champaign-Urbana, the local public health district here is working with Carle Health System and the University of Illinois to be able to conduct on-site testing. But that has not launched yet, but it's in the works. As far as drive-through testing, you know, there are some clinics that are starting to do that, whether it's drive-through with a car to get sample collection that would then be sent to a lab for testing, or lots of hospitals are setting up tents outside of the hospital so that patients who call ahead and meet the certain criteria once they've been screened on the phone or online, they come in and then they can get, the doctors or nurses can come out in their protective gear and collect samples for testing. So that we are starting to see that ramp up, both in East Central Illinois, as well as in many, many other parts of the state. It's been ramping up in lots of places.
We're talking about COVID-19 testing in Illinois with Christine Herman, health reporter with WILL's Illinois Newsroom. Also, Mary Hansen from NPR Illinois and Kaiser Health News National Health Policy correspondent Roshana Pradhan. Mary, do we know what Illinois' current testing capacity is currently?
So for the state managed labs, those are the ones run by the Illinois Department of Public Health. There's 3 of those, one in Chicago, one in Springfield, and one down in Carbondale. And they're saying that they're running about 600 tests a day. That's up from about 50 tests a day back in February. So testing from those labs is ramping up. But as Christine mentioned there, some of the hospitals are you know, partnering with private labs. And trying to, you know, ramp up their own testing capabilities as well.
And Roshana, I want to ask you about some national perspective. Is there any way to gauge where Illinois is faring compared to other states when it comes to testing?
Well, I think the thing that Illinois has in common with pretty much every other state in the country is basically begging the federal government for more testing capabilities. Governor Pritzker has been out there, as have many others, saying we really need more, not just tests, but as I said, there are chemicals called reagents and other supplies that are needed in order to detect confirmed cases of COVID-19. And he's been repeatedly saying that the state needs more. I think Illinois, one thing about it is that when the CDC again initially started sending kits in February to state and county labs, Illinois was among the very, very first states that got tests. And it's because, as you all know, that the state was the place where the first likely person-to-person transmission of the virus took place. And so I do think there was somewhat of an effort to prioritize slightly on that as far as when states got tests. But I mean, really, because the supply was so limited to begin with, in the initial batches that states were getting and counties were getting, they were really not that far off from each other, sort of regardless of how big a place was population-wise, which is, that was one of the things in a story I wrote earlier this week that I just found really astounding. One of the examples I had in there was New York City. Of course, New York City has 8.6 million people. And in early February, the initial kit they got from the CDC, they could have tested 300 patients, which is really nothing in a city that large. So I think that's kind of the struggle. States and counties have been able to order additional tests from the CDC at this point, but it's still slow to sort of come online.
And do we have any kind of perspective about the distribution of testing kits here in the United States compared to other countries?
I think in other countries that have been lauded for their success on testing, really, you know, they have their healthcare systems are much more different than the United States, right? We have a lot of state and county and local variation just because of the way that things are run here, right? The U.S. is sort of this federalist model where we obviously have federal resources and federal government power, but a lot of these things are left up to state officials. Whereas I think in other nations, you know, it's much more nationalized. So it is a bit hard to say exactly how the same scenarios will play out elsewhere. But I do think it's fair to say, you know, as you noted, places like South Korea and Japan, I mean, their testing capability is just much, much more widespread because they just have infrastructure that we just don't have in the U.S.
Mary, we talked with Christine earlier, and she tells us about an emergency room doctor that was concerned about the lack of testing. Have you heard similar concerns from healthcare workers in Sangamon County?
Yes, definitely. One local hospital official told me last week that, you know, they're having to make some really tough decisions about who to test because of the lack of testing. You know, they said their physicians are seeing people, and there are some people that they want to test that they just can't right now. So the goal in the next couple of weeks is to make sure that you know, that those physicians can test who they think they need to.
Ratana, what would it take for the U.S. to get up to speed with massive testing, especially as this virus continues to spread exponentially?
I really think that at this point, I mean, it's really dependent on labs in the private sector that are going to be able to make the U.S. have broad-based testing capability. So part of that is, you know, removing and bureaucratic hurdles, you know, for hospitals and other commercial lab companies to get testing going. And I think that has begun to happen, but we still are seeing difficulties around the nation with even with places like LabCorp and Quest and drive-through testing coming online. People are still having a lot of difficulty in accessing tests. I think the other thing is that the FDA has more rapidly in recent days been approving other tests that have quicker turnaround times. So we're talking maybe potentially minutes or hours as opposed to multiple days for people to get a diagnosis back. So I think that's what it's going to take to see the U.S. catch up. But it's just a major question how many people will get exposed to the virus in that amount of time.
We've been speaking with Christine Herman, health reporter with WILL's Illinois Newsroom. Also, we heard from Mary Hansen with NPR Illinois in Springfield and national health policy correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Rashana Pradhan. And I want to thank all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up after the break, research from the University of Illinois suggests that practicing yoga could lead to improved brain health. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Whether it's a brisk walk or a quick jog, exercise just makes us feel better, especially after being cooped up in the house all day. And we know it's good for our mental health, too. Those benefits have been well documented in research studies for decades. When it comes to yoga, though, much less is known, despite its growing popularity. Research analysis from the University of Illinois suggests yoga may have benefits for people beyond increasing flexibility and strength. The research suggests that the practice could actually improve brain health in ways similar to aerobic exercise. Back in December, Lee Gaines sat down with Neha Gotte. Neha is a director of the Exercise Psychology Lab at the Department of Kinesiology and Community at the University of Illinois. She also co-led the research analysis on yoga and its effect on the brain. Lee also spoke with Ashley Kostolovich. She's a certified yoga instructor and is trained in mindfulness-based stress reduction. She founded a nonprofit called Yoga for a Mindful Midwest, which also helps bring yoga into schools and communities.
For our listeners who are unfamiliar with the practice, could you provide a brief description of what yoga actually is?
Sure. So yoga is quite a historic form of exercise, primarily dating and originating in India. So it's really this hybrid, holistic form of movement, incorporating breathing, mindfulness, and meditation all in one.
And I'm curious why you wanted to look at the effect of the practice on brain health.
So much of the science looking at exercise effects on brain health or cognition has focused on aerobic exercise. The oldest study with aerobic exercise dates back to the 1970s. And so there has been some leading evidence since then that examines aerobic activities. However, when you think of yoga, there is this, again, unique element of mindfulness or mind-body connection as you're engaging in the practice. And so I was curious to see whether that mindfulness element has something more to add in terms of the benefits that the body and the mind can gain from practice.
And it sounds like we in the West have been studying exercise's effect on the brain for quite some time, but we haven't really delved that much into yoga. Is that correct?
Yes. So we tried to examine how many studies have been done looking at yoga and cognition, or even yoga per se. And we only see an uptick in the 2000s. So much of, although yoga has existed for a long, long time, the science of yoga is just evolving.
And so with the science that's currently available, what do we know about how the practice impacts brain health?
So we, in our paper, reviewed 11 different studies that looked at the yoga effect on brain health, brain structure. Again, it's a small pool of studies, again, highlighting the fact that this is a very new, nascent field. There is definitely a lot of interest since yoga is becoming more and more popular. But the 11 studies we looked at and the results that showed very much similarities between aerobic effects and yoga effects. There are some key areas of the brain that seem to be affected by yoga practice. Those 11 studies seem to show those consistently. Just to briefly name them, they are the hippocampus, which is considered the memory center of the brain. We have amygdala, which is, again, part of the limbic system, part of emotional regulation of the body, stress response, anxiety, fear responses. And then we have the cingulate cortex and the prefrontal cortex. So these are regions of the brain that are right behind your forehead and are responsible for higher order cognitive processes such as thinking, decision making, problem solving. So really processes that make us different and set us apart as humans, as mammals.
Would you say that the effects of yoga on these parts of the brain are positive, or what we would consider positive?
Yes. So in terms of the neuroscience terminologies, we often look at the volume of these specific structures, and we see that yoga practitioners have larger volumes for these structures in the brain.
These parts of their brain are physically larger.
Yes, yes. They are physically larger as you compare them with control subjects or control groups, which in science is groups of individuals who do not engage in yoga practice. And so those could again mean that they have more neurons in the brain that are structured in those areas. It could also mean that there are more arteries and more angiogenesis in those regions in the brain.
So we are seeing that this practice is helping with memory, potentially anxiety reduction, thought processes. Ashley, I'd like to bring you into the conversation here. You know, as someone who teaches yoga in schools, are Neha's findings surprising to you?
No, not at all, actually. This is something that I see pretty much on a daily basis, and I have for years now.
So how do these effects manifest in the children you work with? So children that you've been consistently teaching yoga to?
After most classes, directly after the classes, major feedback is always kids feel calm, relaxed, lighter, and then just plain good. It turns out all the energy they carry around with them, most of the time unknowingly, they kind of have a chance to work it out. So the feedback is always pretty positive.
And Ashley, could you tell me a little bit about the nonprofit that you founded and why you wanted to start that nonprofit?
Sure. I founded a few years ago an organization called Student Yoga and Mindfulness Project. And just last year, we created a not-profit called Yoga for a Mindful Midwest. And I created the not-profit or the initial organization because of all the positive effects that yoga and mindfulness had created in my own life. So personally, I had felt these benefits and I could see them and measure them in my life. And I thought, well, nobody else is doing it around here. Let's see if I can bring it into the schools. And it started just as an after-school activity. I volunteered quite a bit. And then eventually we started bringing it into the schools. So in the daytime, I bring these things into classrooms.
And is this based in Springfield or do you go to other places as well?
So we are based in Springfield, Illinois. But right now I'm traveling to Decatur once a week. I've been doing that for about a year now. I visit Eisenhower High School, and I work with the additional needs children there. And like I said, I do that once a week, and they've invited me back again this year. And that's kind of a pattern I'm starting to see, as I start just with a 10-week program where I go in and I offer different ways to teach the children yoga and mindfulness. And teachers, school administrators, principals just keep extending my contracts. So
they must like what you're doing.
They do. Yeah, I mean, they're able to see the benefit. So that's happened here in District 186 in Springfield. I just keep getting invited into more and more schools. And then the surrounding towns like Chatham, Riverton, Rochester. I'm pretty much all in all the little towns around Springfield.
I think many people, when they think of yoga as it's practiced in the Western world, they often think of it as something that's for wealthy, thin, white women. But it sounds like, you know, you've made it a mission to bring yoga to children and also, I think, to people who have been impacted by trauma in their lives. Is that correct?
That is correct. Our mission deals primarily with bringing these things to underserved populations. So whether it was in the beginning working with organizations like Boys and Girls Club, there's a local nonprofit here, Compass for Kids, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, whether it's working with them or going into the schools that are in the areas that are, you know, are more impacted by poverty. And then just recently, outside of just bringing it to the children, I'm now contracted with our public health here. I go once a week and I actually bring it in to adults who are coming in to get assistance with things like rent, utilities, et cetera. That's a mission of ours. It's very important to us.
I'm curious why that's so important to you.
Growing up in poverty, lots of trauma, you know, a father in and out of prison, mom, multiple sclerosis, real bad mental illness issues, lots of addiction in the family. So growing up as one of those children, you know, it would have been amazing to have these things when I was younger. And so, again, it's very personal to me. I want to be able to make it more accessible to the folks who normally wouldn't have access.
Thank you for sharing that, Ashley. And, you know, as a researcher, Neha, I wonder, should there be efforts to bring the practice to some of these vulnerable populations?
Absolutely. I think what Ashley is doing is really important. Even in our research studies, we tend to get kind of a biased population when we advertise participants and are recruiting and seeking participants for our studies. And by and large, we see individuals who volunteer for our studies tend to be well-educated, high income, primarily Caucasians. And so it's really important to diversify this population and bring yoga to everyone. And we try to do that through our studies by targeting specific subgroups. However, I think what Ashley is doing is really kind of more grassroots, and that's something that's really needed.
I'm also curious, Neha, you know, we know something about how yoga affects the brain, whether it's anecdotal stories like what we're hearing from Ashley, and also the scientific evidence that you've referenced. I'm curious what we don't know yet about how this practice is impacting our brain health.
Yeah, so there are a few different questions that still need to be answered from a scientific perspective. One is, when you say yoga, there are so many different styles of yoga, and more so in the West. I feel like every few weeks I read something new in the papers. It's not just the true practice of yoga, but it's also very commercialized in the West. But going back to the scientific question, the question remains, what is it about this practice that tends to impact the brain? Is it the movement and the poses? Is it the breathing and the meditation? Or is it really a holistic combination of all these elements that is necessary to see these brain effects and brain changes? The second element is we still don't know what the dose needs to be. So if yoga is good for your brain, how much yoga do you really need to do? And so to answer that question, really, we need large-scale studies. We need different groups of individuals who practice different doses of yoga, different frequencies, different hours a week, and then determine whether there is an optimal threshold that needs to be practiced if you're looking to gain some health benefits or some brain health benefits.
It sounds like there's still a lot of research that needs to be done.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, Ashley, I'm curious, what would you say to people who might be skeptical about yoga's impact on brain health for children, or skeptical about some of the work that you're doing?
Well, I would say that I understand, because I think a lot of it does come down to the legitimacy. And going back to why I think Neha's research is so important, when I go into places, there are still, as popular as yoga has become, there are still a lot of folks who think it's one thing or the other. So whether they think I'm coming in and teaching them something religious, or if they chalk it up to something more new age, it's kind of woo-woo stuff. So the more scientific data I can bring these folks, the better it is for me, and the more access folks will have for it. Because I do talk to children about the brain. We talk about the upstairs brain and the downstairs brain. We talk about their PFC, their prefrontal cortex, and talk about their lizard brain, their amygdala. So they do have sort of a reference point. But again, so much of it comes down to the experiential. So when the adults come in and they're able to not only learn a little bit about it, and they're able to see the children practicing and then hear feedback afterwards. And when this stays consistent and they also see that the benefits grow, they tend to have a change of heart.
That was Lee Gaines speaking with Ashley Kristalovich, a certified yoga instructor who is trained on mindfulness-based stress reduction. Ashley also founded a nonprofit called Yoga for a Mindful Midwest, which helps bring yoga into schools and communities. And Lee spoke with Neha Gote, who is a director of the Exercise Psychology Lab at the Department of Kinesiology and Community at the University of Illinois. She also co-led the research analysis on yoga and its effect on the brain. That's it for us today. Listen to these segments again at 21stshow.org or wherever you get your podcasts. We're committed to getting through this health crisis together, even as we practice social distancing. For the next few Thursdays, we are going to have therapists or counselors to share advice on how you and your family can cope with social distancing. Let us know what you're doing while spending more time than normal at home, alone, or with your family. Record a voice memo on your phone and send it to talk@21stshow.org and share how you're coping with staying in, or if you have a question about how to not let it get to you. Again, send that voice memo to talk@21stshow.org. The 21st is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpazon is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Reginald Hardwick. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you for listening.